Today, we're talking about the pitfalls and strategies for navigating asset division.
How might the fear of financial insecurity post-divorce lead to being too aggressive when it comes to asset division?
Yeah, divorce is all about fear, right? It's done wrong. People come to it in a place of fear and often go through the entire process in a place of fear. As the conversation starts to devolve into how am I supposed to survive on that? Man, how many times have we heard those words, right? How am I supposed to survive on that? It's a clinging to the past. We built this home together. I don't want to walk away from it. Why? Because it isn't the home you built together anymore. It is now the home that you left together.
Welcome, Christopher. How are you today?
I am well, and I'm excited to be here as well. So thank you. And I hope something I've learned over the past 30 years is going to be valuable, but we'll see.
I'm sure there's at least one or two nuggets in there for the crowd today. Here we go. Are you ready for the first question?
I doubt it, but let's do it anyway.
Okay. The first question is, how might the fear of financial insecurity post-divorce lead to people being maybe too aggressive or too defensive when it comes to asset division?
Yeah, divorce is all about fear, right? It's done wrong. People come to it in a place of fear and often go through the entire process in a place of fear. And it's really important to try to move past. One of the things that my team focuses on from the very first moment we meet a client is to start to paint a picture of the future, because all the fear is actually rooted in the past. We've been trained to be worried about things, been trained that they don't have control, been trained that they're not capable, and by trained, I don't mean there's somebody who ran them through a class, but I mean, it's just like the life experience. And so by envisioning the future, making sure you're making a clear picture of what the future should look like, we can move past the fear of financial insecurity. So why is it important to do that? First of all, making any decisions in your life, I don't care what they are, I don't care if it's what you're going to have for dinner, from a place of fear leads to bad decision-making. And it's also the most powerful emotion we've got. Our brain, and I am not a neuroscientist or anything of that nature, I just know enough to be dangerous. But one thing I understand is that our brains are layered. The smartest stuff is on the outside. And as you go deeper, you get to our more basic and more basic brains. And our most basic brains are keep you alive and keep you fed, right? Those are the two things. And so keeping alive, the most important one, is all about fear. Run away. Be afraid of things. You're going to die. And that those basic emotions, it's like when you say a fear of financial insecurity, those are fancy words. The real word is, I'm afraid I'm going to die, right? And so then people come to their decision-making from that perspective. And so when you ask about overly aggressive or overly defensive behaviors in asset division, it's all coming from a place of this is all there is, right? I'm never going to be able to put this back together. This is all there is. It's Humpty Dumpty. And so I need to hoard and grab and protect every single thing. There's also other emotions at play here. Anger. She screwed me. He screwed me. And so I'm going to get back. I deserve for the pain she put me through. But the fear of the post-divorce financial security is very real. So what I encourage people to do is to take a different approach to the asset division before getting into negotiations, before talking with your spouse. Soon to be X. We're starting to use that. It looks like Starbucks, STBX. We've been using that lately. And make your own decisions, because it no longer has to do with them. And that's like the part where we have to get really clear, is like that it no longer has to do with them. It only has to do with you and the future that you want. Now, I'm not saying to walk away. And by any means, you've built a marriage. You've built it's like a corporation. You've built this marital together. And it is fair for you to have the fruits of your labor. But notice how it's fair to have the fruits of your labor is very different than I need everything I can get so I can survive. I need everything I can get so I can survive. If both parties are approaching it from that perspective, it's just going to be a fight. It's a fight over the last bush. It's the fight over the last orange on the tree. It's the fight over the last piece of meat on the carrion, right?
It's in some states roadkill.
It's a zero-sum game. But if you approach it rather than from a place of fear, from a place of I've built this and I want it to be fair to me, then you also are approaching it from a perspective of I want it to be fair for them. And then when you approach from a perspective of fairness rather than fear, then you can have a conversation about what's fair. And as soon as the conversation starts to devolve into how am I supposed to survive on that, man, how many times have we heard those words, right? How am I supposed to survive on that? We need to take a break from the conversation because that's not about fairness anymore. Both parties are going to feel that way and both parties are going to be wrong. You're going to survive. You are a capable person. You're going to survive. And you should at least start off this next chapter of your life, which you should define clearly what you want it to be from a place of fairness. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And it's actually a great jumping off point for the next question. Your first answer is about those instincts and neediness and just sort of the general experience of, oh my God, what's going to happen with the money? This one is more about the particular things. All right. So in what ways can deep emotional attachments to certain assets, like the family home or maybe a piece of furniture, complicate the process of fair and objective asset division? And I just like to say that we've got a piece of stickly furniture in our house that nobody likes. That was one of those, it probably cost us a lot more than it was worth to get out of the divorce, pieces of furniture. Yeah. So that's what this question reflects, is what could come out of that kind of over attachment to a particular thing?
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned the stickly. I've had a few cases where it's not been about, I'm so emotionally attached, I have to have this thing, as to whether who's going to get stuck with this ugly chair. And it's been a family heirloom. Somebody's got to keep it. We can't sell it. We can't burn it. But the more common one is what you're talking about, the emotional attachment to things. And in a sense, I'm like a broken record, right? We have to go back to, so what is the life you want to live? Generally speaking, the emotional attachment to things is a surrogate. It's not what you're really feeling. It's just what you're really feeling in the moment. It is an attempt to hold on to the past. And really, in order to be successful through this process, divorce is change, and change is about the future. And the more we keep change rooted in the past, the more the past will control us. And we don't, generally speaking, that means that we're going to limit our future accordingly. The family home, right? You mentioned that as one of the examples. And it's not, first of all, it's not always possible to hold on to the family home, right? The whole old adage of two can live as cheaply as one bears some truth. And it's going to be one times two again, which means in order to be able to continue the standard of living, to have a house like the house you had, to have a car like the car you had, blah, 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 is going to require more resources. Now, does that mean you can't have it? Absolutely not. If that's the life you want in the future, then we should talk about what you're going to do to build that. Again, we want to start from a place of fairness. Going forward, you're going to have some responsibility for building that life. And then when you picture that life, do you need that chair in it? Is that chair an essential part of that life that you're picturing going forward? There are some things, I could think of a client who had a grandfather clock that was passed down from the great-grandparents to the grandparents, to the parents, to the client. And the idea was the client wanted to pass it on to the children. And in a sense, it's an interesting onion to unravel, because when you ask the question, why do you want to pass it on to your children? And particularly when you ask the question of, if you're honest with yourself, Do your children want it? And will their children want it? What are we hanging on to here? And I'm not saying that, you know, it's not Marie Kondoing everything and seeing if it gives you joy. But you should take that moment. Why are we holding on to this? And then you'll see that it's actually very few things that are truly essential. And the rest are clinging to the past. The family home is the key one, right? It's a clinging to the past. We built this home together. I don't want to walk away from it. Why? Because it isn't the home you built together anymore. It is now the home that you left together. And do you want to be tied to that past? And listen, I'm not making a decision for you. I'm just saying that people should be asking that question first. And if you lead with first envisioning your future, and then asking yourself, does this fit the future, rather than holding onto the things and building a future around them, is a much healthier way to approach this and will lead to much lower conflict in the asset division.
Got it. All right. And now down to question number three. And this is really a personal understanding question. And in my experience working as a divorce coach, people don't always, actually, it's really unusual. A better way to put this is really unusual for one person on either side to fully understand every aspect of the assets. It seems like one person understands the household expenses, the other person understands more the big picture, long-term stuff, because that's how partners work usually. But there always seems to be at least some not complete understanding of assets. So that's what's driving this question. There's some people who are completely in the dark about assets. So what are the potential consequences of not fully understanding the value of shared assets or the implications of asset division?
Right. This is so frequently it, right? You're absolutely right. One party might know what everything in the 401k is really worth, and one party might know what the toy train collection in the basement that's been gathering dust is actually worth. And one party might know what the I'm forgetting what the name of those little German dolls, but that collection is worth. And everybody's got different ideas of the assets. And if you don't, and in many marriages, there are parts of the assets that are really not talked about, not shared. It's much the individual. There's nothing wrong with it. I'm not suggesting, oh, we should share everything the whole time. No, it's okay. People have different passions. And the value of things then gets tied up with the market value, the personal value, and other values that you might assign to them. But when it comes to asset division, if we have to arrive at a shared understanding of the values so that we can properly divide the assets. And it goes both ways, right? I might think, oh, my 1966 Mustang that's not functional in the garage is worth a lot because it's a project I want to do. And my spouse might think it's not worth much. Those are actually easier. It's the other way around that's harder. When I've got an asset that on it that I think that I want to keep, that I think is worth very little, and the spouse is trying to put a much elevated asset value to it. So how do we resolve this? And the answer is it's not easy. And the way we resolve it is to agree on a mechanism, right? So there are several mechanisms depending on the kind of asset. The easiest one are things that are marketable. Let's just find what the fair market value is. If it's a car, let's go to Kelley Blue Book. If it's a house, let's get an appraisal. If it's people get some thumbnail approaches with Zillow or one of those sites. If it's something a little, if it's stocks, it's easier. What are they worth on the market? It's a business. We need to get an expert business valuation. And if it's things that are less and less tangible, less and less marketable, we have to come up with different mechanisms. Who's a third party who we trust to put a value on it? Who knows about these things that can put a reasonable value on it? And maybe you get yours, I'll get mine, we'll meet in the middle, or we'll just agree on a person that we both trust. But it is absolutely essential to not argue about the value of the thing. Discuss and agree on a method of valuation and then leave it to that method is the best way to approach this. Because if you get hung up on arguing about the value of the thing, who's right? I don't know who's right. There's a lot of aspects that can go into valuing a thing. And the less marketable it is, the less fungible it is, the more unique it is, the harder it is to come to an agreement on a value if you're just going to go head to head or let your lawyers go head to head. That's no better. Now you're just paying other people a whole lot of money to do the same thing that you're not able to do. You're much better off spending your time on agreeing on a method of valuation and then being okay with living with the consequences. Yeah, otherwise you're just going to get hung up there and you'll never come to an agreement. And the worst thing, in my opinion, is to then leave it. You're going at it, and you're just going to fight about it. And then you're going to go into court and ask a judge to decide. That's not going to be a good result for somebody, right? Because it's not going to be based on anything that you guys have agreed on as a methodology. Agree on a method. Worst case scenario, have that person come in and tell the court what they think it's worth to give the court something to hang their head on using a methodology that you've already agreed to.
It makes a lot of sense.
Through the learning experience, right? So we're going to, this is most people, knock wood, will only go through this once. So it's not natural. It's not rote. You're in a space where you don't know the rules. You don't know what's going to happen next. And so going through this exercise really helps to get you into the present, into the space so that you can make the best possible decisions for yourself and your family.
Yeah. If we're learning, we won't make the same mistakes.
Hopefully. Right, so
can you share examples of how you have helped clients navigate the emotional complexities of asset division?
Yeah.
So the family home.
Yeah. So our approach is to borrow a little bit from your approach, Richard, which is we mix in a good dose of coaching in our representation. And very often we actually work alongside a coach so that the client gets even more than a little dose from a coaching professional, because we're legal professionals. And between us and among us, what we tend to do, and I'll sound like a broken record a little bit, but you know what? This is so important, and it is the core of everything that I don't mind repeating it, is we focus on the future, not the fight. And in order to do that, we have to work with you, the client, the person going through this family change, on building a clear, personal vision of your future that you believe in and that you want. So you asked for examples. That's the method, right? So what's an example? Example would be to a couple that is splitting, and there's a family house, two cars. We'll call them the Joneses. Why not? That's not a real name. I'm not using the real name. And a dog, right? And some family heirlooms and all this and all that. And so when working with our client, preparing our client for mediation, preparing our client for negotiation, we first listen. The example is to first listen to hear what's important. And then to challenge what's important based on that. So for the first thing was to build that vision of the future, right? Then listen what's important to them in the asset division. Fairness is important, but also I want to keep grandma's. You wanted an example. I want to keep grandma's George Foreman grill. That is a real life example. This was a $1 million estate, and we're talking about grandma's George Foreman grill. Grandma passed it to us, and it was my grandma, not his grandma. Yes, it was a gift to us, but it really should be mine, but he's fighting over it too. And then say, okay, let's talk about the future we were talking about. How does the George Foreman grill fit into that future? And when we have that conversation, we realize that it doesn't, right? It just doesn't, it's not important in that picture of the future. And so by focusing on the future, and then asking, how does this fit into that future? We get to really test the, you know, what you used in your question, strong attachment to the asset. We get to test that and dissolve that and really help the client to feel okay about that, because what they want is their future, not the George Foreman grill. In keeping that focus, we keep the emotions at bay and really focus on building, because that's what we're doing, right? In an asset division, in a divorce, we're not taking apart a marriage. We're building the future. And if we can keep that focus, the emotion can be removed to the extent necessary to make solid decisions for your future.
I love it. I love the way that you are working, not just with the legal side, but you're helping with the emotional side. And I'm curious how that applies when you're assisting clients in achieving a sense of financial security post-divorce, especially in cases where they're afraid that they just don't have enough.
And you said helping with the emotional stuff, not just the legal stuff. But yeah, at the end of the day, we're not therapists and we're not financial advisors. So we know a little bit, but what we do is we will, as needed, I told you, we involve coaches. We will recommend therapy and we will recommend a conversation with a financial planner. Because in building that future, the important part, I think I've said it before, but I'll try to reemphasize it, is to make it real. It's not enough to just build a kind of woo picture of the future with rainbow castles and unicorns, but it needs to be real. And it gets real by actually planning it out to a pretty high level of detail. And so part of that might be if the client is worried, if you're worried about financial security, what does that mean? Does that mean you're worried about having a meal on your table? Is that worried about having a roof over your head? Or is it worried about whether you'll be able to maintain the country club membership? Also can be very important because that could be the focus of your social life. But what does it mean? And then, so we first have to say, okay, when you say you're worried about your financial security, what does that mean? What are you worried you're not going to be able to do? And then we talk with a financial planner about what will it take to be able to do what you want to do? And of course, going back to that picture of the future, always asking the question, why is that important? And if the answer is only because it's what we've always done, then we need to explore that, right? Because that's not a good enough answer. It's why is it important to you right now? Why will it be important to you in the future? Once we can come to that answer, then we can start to work on why. Because once that's real, then we can have a conversation about what do we need to do? How far will the assets that we're going to be able to get you here take you in a fair and equitable division of assets? And then what else will you need to do, right? Focus on the future. If you stay focused on the asset division, as many law firms do, then you're focused on now and you're focused on the past. And again, I used the term earlier, it's a zero sum game. What you get, she doesn't. What she gets, you don't. As opposed to that being a piece of a much bigger puzzle about what are you going to need to do? What is it going to take to live life the way you want to live it? The assets that you're getting in the asset division aren't all of it. Just like they wouldn't be if you were staying married. You wouldn't go, we've got everything we're ever going to have. How are we going to make our life based on this? That's not how marriages work. That's not how relationships work. You say, how are we going to build on what we've got to achieve the life we really want? That's the same question you should be asking yourself in a divorce, in a separation, and using the resources like financial planners, therapists, coaches to help you get there, to understand it, to build that future, understand what it takes, and then move forward. That's how we assist.
What a great frame to put on it. It's so easy to get stuck in the weeds when you're in the divorce process. And I love the way you're calling people to look more to the future and get that they're still productive. They're still generative. They're still creative. Hey, I got one last question for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's about, we've covered some very specific stuff in the last couple of days. This question is the open field question.
Okay.
What are the common pitfalls that you've observed that we haven't covered yet here? And how do you help your clients to effectively address those pitfalls?
The common pitfalls, I think, are the ones we have covered, quite honestly. But the most common pitfall that we haven't covered is not knowing what you've got, right? It's what are you bringing to the table? Are you able to put together a schedule of your assets and debts? Can you find it all? Can you describe it all? And do you have a fair idea of what your spouse is going to have on their side of the table? And it's not just the unawareness. It's that a lot of clients get blocked because, did everybody know the Kenny Rogers song, The Gambler? You never count your money while you're sitting at the table. There's lots of time for counting once the dealing's done. And that's true here too, is people don't like to count their money while they're sitting at the table being their marriage. And the fact that they're counting the money means they're counting it for a reason to divide it. And it's bringing that reality closer. And I don't care if you're the one suing for divorce or the one that's been sued for divorce, if it was mutual or one-sided. The fact of the matter is that we don't know what life is going to look like on the other side. Therefore, that's scary. And for a lot of folks, it is just scary enough to not want to bring it into reality right now. And one of the common pitfalls is that reluctance to assess, to gather, to define, and to count the money. And how do you get around that? Once again, going to broken record Anderson. The way you get around that, the way you get through that block, is to take the fear out of that future and say, let's talk about what it's going to be. Because now you're counting money so that you can facilitate something you do want, so that you stop running away from the marriage that you had or that you're being pushed out of, doesn't matter, and start running towards, or moving at least towards, the future that you want, a future that you want. And the common pitfall of not being able to face counting the assets is, I think, the one we haven't talked about.
I love it. I love it. And how do you help them face those? How do you help them face it?
That's just the way I've been talking about, just by building, like, we spend a whole lot of time before we count money, before we talk about asset division, before we talk about fair valuation, before we talk about what the other side's got, before we talk about any of that. We just sit down, say, so what's your life like in 2 years?
Nice.
And don't, that's not just like an open-ended question, like they give you an answer. It's nice. No. Where do you live? Where do you drive? If you have kids, where are they going to school? What are your vacations like? Are you in another relationship or are you not? What are you doing with your parents? What, like, all of it. You build a detailed picture of that future, then you talk about this stuff.
Wow, that's really excellent.
Yeah.
Christopher, that's all we have time for today. And I understand you have an offer for the people in the workshop today.
Absolutely. For those in the workshop in states that we serve right now, Colorado, but always check out New Leaf Family. We're expanding into New York, New Jersey, Arizona, Utah, and others. But for right now, in the states that we do serve, if you have seen us on this workshop, you may have a 30-minute coaching session free of charge. And just you use the code Anderson told me. That's your code. And we'll give you a half-hour coaching session to start to talk about the things that we were talking about here to get you on your way. No obligation. One of my team members or me will have a conversation with you about these very things.
And again, right now, that offer, we get people from all over. That offer is really for people in Colorado, because you can't work in another state right now until you've got those offices in New York and New Jersey and other places you're looking at.
That's right. So right now, Colorado, Richard, I expect that this will be on the air for years and years.